Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Church and Women. Pope Benedict devotes his catechesis to the figure of St. Hildegard of Bingen, the 12th century German nun and mystic. Miracle Man. We talk to the American deacon whose inexplicable healing from a serious spine disorder has paved the way for the forthcoming beatification of Cardinal Newman during Pope Benedict's visit to Britain this month. And Pakistan's ongoing plight. We find out the latest about Pakistan's devastating flooding and the huge challenges facing the country from a Caritas worker who's just got back from there. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict devoted his catechesis to the figure of the 12th century nun and mystic St. Hildegard of Bingen, saying she reminds us of the contribution which women are called to make to the life of the Church in our time. Chris Altieri reports.
Continuing his series of catecheses on the great figures of the Middle Ages, Pope Benedict XVI turned this Wednesday to St. Hildegard of Bingen, the great abbess and mystic of the 12th century.
Anche in quei secoli della storia che noi abitualmente chiamiamo medioevo, diverse figure femminili spiccano per la santità della vita e la ricchezza dell'insegnamento.
A woman of great learning in a broad variety of fields, St. Hildegard wrote works on subjects as diverse as theology, botany, and medicine.
One of the outstanding women of the Middle Ages, Hildegard used her spiritual gifts for the renewal of the Church and the spirit of our authentic Christian living.
The Holy Father went on to say that St. Hildegard reminds us of the contribution women are called to make to the life of the Church in our own time. I'm Chris Altieri.
One of the highlights of Pope Benedict's historic state visit to England and Scotland later this month will be the beatification of the 19th century theologian and convert Cardinal John Henry Newman. The significance of this event is underlined by the fact that this will be the first time ever that Pope Benedict has personally beatified a person since his election to the papacy. Cardinal Newman was an Anglican cleric who founded the Oxford movement to bring the Anglican Church back to its Catholic roots. He became a Catholic at the age of 44 after a succession of clashes with Anglican bishops and was later made a cardinal. Newman died in the city of Birmingham in 1890. His beatification was announced in 2009 after the Vatican declared that the miraculous healing of an American deacon from a crippling spinal condition was a result of Cardinal Newman's intercession. That American deacon was Jack Sullivan from the Archdiocese of Boston, and he told me more about the outbreak of his spinal illness and how he was inexplicably healed after praying to Cardinal Newman.
The problem began on June 6th of the year 2000. I woke up that morning with severe pain in the back of both my legs. I was rushed to a local hospital, and after reading a CAT scan that was performed, the doctor explained to me that the lumbar vertebrae in my lower back, together with the disc, for some reason had turned inward, squeezing the spinal cord. And the doctor recommended that I immediately consult with a spinal surgeon in one of the larger Boston hospitals, as my lower functions could shut down and I could become paralyzed. And there was serious concern about that. Finally, I met with the chief spinal surgeon of one of the larger hospitals in Boston, who performed a myelogram and indicated to me that the bone from the disc and the vertebrae were not only squeezing the spinal cord, but there were bulges above and below the affected area, that I needed immediate surgery or I'd be paralyzed. And he scheduled surgery for early September. Unfortunately, I was scheduled to return to my formation classes to become a permanent deacon in the Archdiocese of Boston. I had completed 2 years and was expecting to enter into my third year. But realizing the severity of this, obviously, I consented to the surgery, but I was totally distraught. I came home and I turned on television set, and on the program, there were two priests talking about Cardinal Newman. I had known only little about him, that he was a convert to Catholicism and a great writer. That's about it. And they were talking about the difficulties Newman had with his vocation and all of the sorrows and misfortunes that he endured.
And when you watched this program, at the end of it, you made a prayer. Was that right?
Correct. At the end, they showed on the screen, if you receive any divine favors from praying to Cardinal Newman, please contact the postulator for the cause of beatification at the Oratory of Birmingham, England. And because they flashed this on the screen, I wrote it down. And then after writing it down, I thought that I should pray to Cardinal Newman with all my heart. My prayer was a relatively simple one. Please, Cardinal Newman, help me to walk so that I can return to classes and be ordained. I didn't ask for healing. I simply wanted to ask for that favor, that divine favor that was so important to me, so uppermost in my mind.
So you went to bed, right? And then tell us what happened.
In the following morning, I woke up totally pain-free. I was just astounded, and as was my wife. I was able to go to work without any pain whatsoever. But the problem is I still had the surgery scheduled for 3 weeks, and I was supposed to start my classes at that time. And I consulted with the second surgeon that I had made arrangements to see, Dr. Robert Banco.
What was his reaction when he saw that you were now pain-free?
Well, first he looked at the films, and he said that I shouldn't be able to walk at all. Then he was astounded when he saw me walking normally without any pain and with strength in my legs. He said to me, I wouldn't recommend that you undertake the surgery without any symptoms, such as pain or disfiguration. He said, go back to classes. I'll stay with your case. This situation can't last for very long, and I'll be available if the pain returns to immediately perform the surgery, hopefully in the Christmas vacation when you have some time. But contrary to what he thought, I was pain-free throughout the first semester and then the second semester for a total of about 9 months. And immediately after the last class, pain returned in full fury. I was scheduled for surgery on August 9th of 2001. And during the procedure, the doctors encountered serious complications. Dr. Banco advised me after the surgery that the dura mater, or the protective lining surrounding the spinal cord, was badly torn and all of the fluids had come out. And instead of being a month or so to recuperate, it was now 4 to 6 months.
And how bad was the pain? Were you able to walk then?
No. I was in total agony, constant agony, so bad that you have difficulty sleeping. I couldn't sleep the first 5 days after the surgery. The pain was just excruciating.
Can you tell us then about your second prayer to Cardinal Newman and what happened?
Yes. I then realized I was in the same situation I was the year before, and I had to at least try to walk. It took me 10 minutes just to get to the side of my bed, and with the nurse's help, to get my feet over the bed and onto the floor. But I had to lean on the bed with my forearms because I couldn't stand up, and I was in total agony. And then in this difficult moment, this moment of great anxiety, I again prayed to Cardinal Newman, the same prayer I said the year before. Please, Cardinal Newman, help me to walk so that I can return to classes and be ordained. And then suddenly I felt tremendous sensation of intense, very strong heat and a very, very strong tingling feeling all over my body.
And what were your feelings also at that time? What were your feelings?
I felt a tremendous sense of peace and joy, a feeling that I've never had before. I was totally captivated, totally transfixed by God's presence. I had no willpower of my own. And then I developed a strong sense of confidence that I could walk, that everything was okay, that everything was going to be fine. And when this feeling, this trance, if you want to call it that, I had no awareness of anything around me during this period of time. And when I came out of it, I was standing up, whereas moments before, I was leaning on the bed in agony, and I could walk. The nurse handed me the walker. I said, "I don't need it. I'm fine. And I started to walk normally out of the room and up and down the corridors. She followed me. I was walking fairly rapidly.
So at this point, you had no further pain, you're saying?
Yes, because I had exclaimed right when I was coming out of this state, "I have no more pain." It was as if it never happened. Of course, I was discharged that same day. And within a week or less, I was walking a mile or two every day.
And you went back, didn't you, to see the surgeon who had operated on you. What did he say? What was his reaction?
Well, recently he did a filmed interview for a film crew from the BBC, and he stated that the spinal cord is usually the size of a quarter, but in my case, it was the circumference of a pea, and I should have been paralyzed during all of this, these 2 years. He said usually recovery from spinal surgery of this type takes from weeks to months, depending upon the severity of the problem, but my back was the worst he'd ever seen, and the most difficult to operate on. He was asked, you know, would you tell us what the prospect of Jack's recovery was? And he said, in my case, actually, there was no recovery period. You see, my condition after the prayer was as if I never had a back problem whatsoever, or even surgery.
So how did he describe your healing? What words did he use? I mean, did he sort of use the word miraculous or what?
He said there was absolutely no medical or scientific explanation for what happened to me. On the first event, he said that situation where I was pain-free for 9 months, although my condition hadn't changed, was totally miraculous. There's never been a case recorded where that has happened. With regard to the second event, he said that his healing, his recovery was instantaneous immediately after his prayer. And in all my years of surgery, I've never seen anything like it. It was truly a miracle.
So he was convinced of that. But I gather that your wife wasn't at first convinced, was she? Tell me a bit about her reaction.
She couldn't piece it together. She knew that my healing was sudden, but she looked at it from a medical perspective, from an earthly perspective. She was delighted that I had recovered so quickly. But as far as a miracle is concerned, these things don't happen. And she was a bit incredulous initially. And as the weeks went by and we talked, she saw all the things I could do. I could walk. I could work outside in my garden, my vegetable garden. I could lift heavy boulders. It took her some time to realize that this wasn't normal, that this was a very, very special happening.
What about yourself after this happened? Were you convinced straight away that this healing was out of the ordinary? What were your feelings after it happened?
Well, I knew that Cardinal Newman had come to my aid right after the first event because I prayed to him and I went to bed, and when I woke up, I was totally pain-free. But after the second event, surely Cardinal Newman had come to my aid a second time in a very dramatic fashion in that case, because I went through that experience of being, you might say, in the presence of God, a very unusual experience, and certainly not a natural experience. But when Dr. Bankel told me these things after we had spoken, after my prayer, after I asked him, "Dr. Bankel, how do you explain these things?" I wanted to get his medical explanation. I knew that Cardinal Newman had interceded for me with God, but I wanted my doctor to tell me what he thought before I wrote the letter. And when he said what he said, that it was a miracle, that there was no scientific or medical explanation what happened in either event, It was then that I decided to write. But the interesting thing about this was that a year later, I was ordained a deacon at the Cathedral of the Holy Cross. And on the same day, the postulator for the cause notified me by email that the fathers of the oratory had voted to begin the process of the beatification of Cardinal Newman and to take my case to Rome.
I was speaking to Deacon Jack Sullivan, whose healing paved the way for Cardinal Newman's beatification. The floodwaters in Pakistan are finally beginning to recede in some areas, but the humanitarian catastrophe affecting millions of victims across the country is far from over. At its peak, the floods submerged or affected around one-fifth of Pakistan, or an area the size of Italy. Aid is slowly reaching the worst affected areas, but millions of people have received little or no help. And the UN has warned that additional funding to help feed the victims in the coming weeks is urgently needed. The scale of the flooding in Pakistan made it one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters ever, with an estimated 1 million homes damaged or destroyed. That's five times as many as were hit by the earthquake in Haiti earlier this year. Monica Kalsich, an emergency aid coordinator from Caritas Austria, has just returned from a 10-day visit to Pakistan, where she toured some of the worst affected areas. She told me about her impressions.
In the south of Pakistan, we are definitely still in an emergency situation. We still have flooded areas. It's still raining in some areas, and where there is no flood, there is mud. So there is no chance for the people to work on the fields.
And how many of those who have been affected by these floods, and we're talking about millions of here, have not received any help or received only a little help? You know, what is the percentage of people who have so far missed out on the relief effort?
I can't give you exact numbers about people who have not yet received aid, but from my own perspective and from what I saw too many people who have not yet received aid. We were distributing a lot of aid, but I saw many people who were demanding aid because it had not yet arrived. The area of this disaster is so enormous that even 4 weeks after the start of the flood, we still have to deliver emergency aid kits to help the people.
And how would you describe the mood of the flood victims? I mean, is it one of desperation? Is it anger?
The longer I was there in the disaster area, the more I saw people being very frustrated and very concerned about what has happened to them, because they started to realize that this catastrophe is a long-term catastrophe for Pakistan and for their life. Most of the affected, nearly all of the affected victims from the flood, are farm workers or daily workers. So they depend completely on the work on the fields. And this won't be possible for the upcoming months because of the flood and the areas which are now completely muddy. I saw women not being able to feed their children, not being able to care about their children, because they were too weak themselves. And to see mothers who have no strength, no power anymore to help their children, this is really a very, very difficult situation to face, because I'm sure that every woman, every mother would give her last to help their own children.
And what are the most pressing needs at the moment in terms of food, water and other relief supplies?
I saw catastrophic hygienic situations in the south. There's so little space in the south where their people were able to put their tents to survive the flood that it is so difficult to access the people. They are surrounded either by the rivers or by the floods. So we need to make sure that the people still get food packages, but also hygienic packages where we have water purification tablets in it, but also medicine in case of diarrhea, which unfortunately is happening.
And when it comes to the health situation, as you say, there's so many waterborne diseases. I mean, what are some of the most worrying situations?
Well, it is very worrying that in no village you find midwives anymore. So those women who need to give birth now, they have to do it on their own without any help. And if there is a midwife, she does not have any instrument to help giving birth to a woman. So these are really bad situations for families who are affected by the flood. And I remember one situation. You know, we do assessments in the affected villages. So we asked children, what did you eat today? And the answer of one boy was chai. Chai means tea. So that was the only thing which he had to eat, what he called eat. But it was nothing else than simply something to drink. And this shows me really that so much is still needed in Pakistan. But we cannot only think about delivering food. We must make sure that the hygienic situation is getting better and that we also care temporary shelter for the upcoming months, especially in the north where the winter months are coming closer.
You went around, as you say, and you saw the people, you witnessed their plight. Have you any anecdotes you can share with us that symbolize the appalling suffering or tragedy that these people are undergoing at the moment?
Well, one situation I remember very well was that in Pakistan we help, we work in a very sensitive social and political environment. We worked in a multi-confessional community in a village where Hindus and Muslims lived together, and where our colleagues, our local partners, said to us, be aware, this is a very sensitive area. We have to make very sure that when we deliver food, it reaches Muslims and Hindus. This was at the border to India. So they asked me, before delivering food, to talk to the people. And I was a little bit concerned what to say to them. What can I say to them coming from Europe, being a Christian? But then I said to the people, we are here not to ask who your God is, but we are here to ask you, what do you need? And the people started to applaud and to say thank you for what I have said to them, because to them it is really not only a situation of big need, it is also a very delicate situation where, because of the lack of food, social tensions can get bigger and bigger. So that is what I witnessed in Pakistan, that we have to be very careful in the way how we help people.
Did you see any signs of tensions between the different religious confessions there?
Fortunately, thanks to the great coordination of our local partners, thanks to their work, what I have seen so far were really very well organized distributions. I have seen too many bad pictures in the media, but unfortunately not on the ground. But these pictures where you see people fighting for a packet of rice, they simply showed me that it is unfortunately possible in Pakistan, because of that difficult social and political situation, that people start to struggle, unfortunately, for aid. If you don't deliver it respectfully to the people in need.
When you talk to people there, were there any kind of remarks that they made that, again, were especially memorable, that summed up somehow their mood at this time?
I remember in the north, when we were in the north, that now we are very much involved in programs which also try to include the affected people in the reconstruction of their destroyed area. It is very important to make sure that people who have lost their jobs, their works as farmers, their work as daily workers in the bazaars, in the markets, that they have something to do and to earn money for the families. Usually the families are very big. And one thing which really concerns, which I really find that worrying, is that there are no schools. There are too many schools destroyed in Pakistan, more than 5,000 schools. So there is an urgent need to build up schools so that the parents can send their children back to schools, because one of our local partners said to me that this might be a long-term problem, talking about the influence of radical Islamic groups. If Pakistan, the government, does not take care of schools being rebuilt, then indeed the children might fall into, we say in German, wrong hands, that there is the danger that radical groups try to catch the children for their purpose. So this was one thing where I really saw the need. Also to make sure, not only to give parents right now, fathers, short-term job, but also to try to organize in our tent camps school, everyday school lessons for the children.
Now, you must have traveled a lot and seen a lot of natural disasters in your time. When you traveled throughout Pakistan and saw the extent of these floods, I mean, what were your own feelings about the scale of this disaster?
Well, I've never seen such a big disaster. I've been to many disasters. I was in India after the tsunami. I've seen wars like the war in Iraq, but I've never seen a flood which affected a whole country. A river called Indus, which goes from the north to the south, 1,500 kilometers through the country, and really destroying everything around it.
You talked about the scale of the disaster, and I saw that, in fact, around 1 million homes have been damaged or destroyed. I mean, that's more than five times the number in the Haiti earthquake, and that seemed huge at the time. So, I mean, we are talking here about a very long-term effort to rebuild this country, aren't we?
It is definitely a very long-term aid situation we are facing in Pakistan. We need to make sure that we don't stop after some weeks. We have to include in our emergency aid work also the time of rehabilitation and rebuilding the affected areas. The United Nations say that it will take around 5 years to rebuild the destroyed Pakistan. And after what I have seen, I absolutely agree with it.
I was talking to Monica Kalsic of Caritas Austria, who's just returned from Pakistan. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.